We're measured, and we measure ourselves by what we be and what we do and what we have. And measurement is of our doingness is what we seem to do the most constantly. Sure, when we're first born, our beingness is measured. You know, they look at us and go, oh, 10 fingers, 10 toes, 2 arms, 2 legs, certain length, a certain weight, a certain amount of hair, and a certain angelic appearance. Whew, what a relief. But very soon after that phase, it's our doing that becomes the focus. It's a question of, do we eat well or not well? Do we sleep well or not well? Do we nap well? Do we sleep through the night? Do we smile on command? Do we pee and poop regularly? Do we look around alertly or not? And our doing is talked about. It's judged positively, or it's judged negatively. Our baby talked today. It stood up for the first time today. It took its first step today. It counted to 10 today. It recited the alphabet today. It tied its own shoes today. It got an A today. It got a gold star today. It did what she or he was told to do today, and on and on. We're measured by our achievements, by our doing, our successful doing. The statistics in a lot of different areas, specifically I want to talk about sports, are all about doing. You know, initially somebody can be admired for, oh, he's the quarterback of the New England Patriots. But right after that sentence, it shifts and the focus becomes, what has he done? What is he doing? What can he do? We judge ourselves by what we do, by what we've accomplished, by the recognition that we got for what we do, how excellently we do things, the fame, the pay, the status, the approval for what we do. And if we don't do or don't do things well, then that life force can leak out of our self-esteem and our self-worth slowly disappears. And all that energy that wants to flow to us, for us, and through us can be distorted into misemotion and illness. Frankly, I think depression and chronic fatigue and a whole bunch of other ailments are really thwarted energy flows due to our erroneous beliefs about doing. This talk is about finishing cycles. We have so many things that are unfinished. They're stacking up. I have things I want to do, I have to do, I should do, and a lot of them have been started. There must be a consciousness-based explanation for this, since I keep adding things to my to-do list, but I don't finish a bunch of them, or I don't remove things that I'm never going to finish. I just keep adding new things, adding new things. Marianne amazed me in so many ways, but one way, I frequently mentioned it to her, is how much she got accomplished when it felt like I was stuck in a stop-go, stop-go, stop-go pattern all day long, pretty much every day. And now, just like before, the clutter around me seemed to be projects that are unfinished cycles. Maybe the solution is simple. Choose one item, pick it up, and take it to completion. That sounds pretty simple, right? Choose one item, pick it up, and take it to completion. As an example, I was journaling the other day, but I also wanted to do what I was writing about. And it's about unfinished business. My daughter Lisa had given me a plaque that can be hung right near me. It was talking about love. And I just needed a screw and a screwdriver and a measuring tape for alignment purposes, and I could have mounted this on the wall. As soon as I do that and mount the plaque, one cycle would be finished, provided, of course, that I put the tools away. If I leave the tools out, then I'm still stuck in that unfinished cycle. And if I put the tools away, then the space where that plaque had been lying on the table would now be clear. That cycle is now completed, and it was clear to me which wall to use. The real variable was, how high should I hang that plaque? Centering was easy. There was no real right height. It's a matter of personal preference. It was going to be near my desk, so I would be looking at it off to the side when I was sitting there. Maybe this easy example has some fundamentals, and that's really what I wanted to do, is underline or discover any principles that may be impacting unfinished cycles. Maybe it's because I was not aware of these principles, kind of like not being aware of gravity. That complicates your life. So I wanted to examine that little teeny episode and to see if there were some principles that could be applied to more complex cycles. And so I decided to make a list of the things that needed to be taken into consideration. And there were half a dozen of them. So, and the first thing was placement. I tend to place everything on horizontal surfaces by default. When in doubt, put it on something flat. That's why I have papers and books on desks, tables, nightstand, countertops, pretty much everywhere that's horizontal. It's got something on it. But it was helpful. I knew that the plaque was better suited for vertical hanging since it had a strap for hanging. The second principle was size. The plaque measured 3 1/4 inches wide by 8 1/4 inches long. So it became clear to me that it didn't really require a gigantic wall space, and where I had in mind, off to the side, was enough. It was important to me because of the nature of this thing, relatively small. I didn't want it miles away. I didn't want it a long way away. I wanted it pretty close to me. So proximity was the deal. I wanted it near to me so I could see it oftentimes. It didn't belong in another room. It didn't belong in the garage. It didn't belong in the office. It didn't belong anywhere other than right there, right by me when I was working. And I knew I had enough space right near me. The fourth thing I took, what principles apply to this particular circumstance? If you're going to hang something on the wall, like pictures and so on, I've done that enough times so I realize that, okay, this involves centering, it involves aligning with other objects on the wall, and I have to take into consideration the desirable height of the object. And, of course, you have to decide on how complicated a project it is that you're involved in, which meant how much time do you think was going to be required for it. In this case, I knew it would not require very much time at all. The tools required. If you're going to sit down and write, what's that take? If you're going to do it on a computer, of course it takes a computer and a keyboard and a monitor so you can see exactly what you're watching or what you're writing. If you're going to write with a pen, like this is how I journal in the morning on three-hole lined paper with a pen. So the tools, I need paper and I need a pen. Easy enough. So that plaque weighed, I'm guessing, 6 ounces or so. So I didn't need a huge screw to support its weight. So I chose the screw, which meant I needed a screwdriver. I needed a measuring tape and a pencil to mark the spot that I was going to put the screw in. So I did it. And, because the screw was shiny, I didn't want it showing up. So I took a black magic marker and covered the head of the screw. So it kind of was almost the same color as the strap. That was good. It no longer stood out. I had all the tools I needed for this project. Next thing I needed to take into consideration, and this is the item number 6 on my list, what could go wrong? What could be unsatisfactory about this process? Well, after looking at the plaque, I could decide that where I put it in the wrong place. Wrong wall, wrong this, wrong that. That didn't turn out to be the case, but the first place I marked with a pencil, when I looked at it again, I went, I think that's a little too low. And I made another mark at a different height, and that's the one I used. That's where the screw went into the wall. Now, my measurement could have been wrong. I could have been miscentered, but it wasn't. In such a small project, not much can go wrong. And even if it went wrong, what's the consequence? Not much. I could cover up a hole that I put in there if I happened to do that. I could have overcome it. I could have patched it. I could have painted over it. So the downside, the dangers, the risk involved in this, really small. Now, some cycles require much more time and space than other cycles. And consequently, we have to do things differently. For example, I was going to send my Bose sound dock off to Bose for repair. I had the paperwork, but I didn't have a box for this device. I really needed to protect it, right? I'm sending it out for repair. I didn't want it to be damaged. So I placed it on the kitchen counter. That's my staging area. Now, I could have used the counter in the laundry room, you know, and if Marianne had been around, that's exactly what I would have done. That would have been my staging area, because the laundry room is right near the door that goes into the garage. So I knew I was going to take the car to the mailboxes, etc. store, where they were going to pack it and ship it for me. On my workspace, I have a whole bunch of thank you cards and sympathy cards, address labels, stamps. But almost all of my writings of these cards at this point is over. So I really could put them in a different place. Finishing cycles includes managing space to get to the point where, you know, everything is in its place and there's a place for everything. I feel good about that. We're looking for that sense of closure. And then we can regain our units of attention and then go to our next project, for instance. That idea of space is important to me. And frankly, I think it's a problem as well. Because if I can't decide on the appropriate space for objects like magazines, the mail, newspapers, you name it, books, I tend to use horizontal spaces for storage. Boop, right on the horizontal space. So where do things fit in time and in space? I bet most of us have challenges even with something more significant. Where do I fit in time and space? Before deciding where other things fit in time and space, fitting in with time is a challenge for us. Moments ago, my computer and software appeared to be working together. It took a long time to get that way. I was battling it, and going this and getting help and staying up till 2:30 in the morning with repair. Consequently, lots of other activities in my life get stacked up. And that always seems to be the case. So I believe, again, that this idea of stacking up, I need to do this, I want to do this, I have to do this, is really a consciousness issue. The other day I realized this. I wanted to vote early for Bernie Sanders. I want to go to the mailboxes, etc., and drop off my Bose. I want to go buy blue cheese salad dressing at Publix. I have a webinar at 2 p.m. and a conference call at 4 p.m. I need to work on a video before the 4 p.m. call. I want to go to a cryotherapy for a session. I'm expecting packages to be delivered from Amazon. I want to meditate at 3 p.m. I should eat something, and I want to continue journaling, and I haven't mentioned all the other ideas that I want to bring into physical manifestation. Whew. These include deciding on when to make reservations to go to Lilydale, New York conferences on psychic development and mediumship, working on spiritual development, listening to various things on CDs and YouTube, etc. Here's a concept that seems so obvious, I can't believe I didn't think of it earlier. What does the finish line look like? What does the end point look like? In other words, how can we know to finish if we don't know what finish actually looks like and feels like? Now, I know for a fact that some of the resistance to finishing cycles is about the fear of being judged, criticized, or attacked. No one ever got a failing grade that proved that they were dumb during the taking of a test. That judgment can only come after the test was in, handed over to the teacher, and was graded, and then the feedback could be delivered. Before that, no threat. No threat of that painful delivery of that kind of a message. And if the finished cycles reinforce the sense of somebody's imperfections, and it's very easy to get there, right, and make that painful, then finishing cycles, like, oh, no, I'm going to avoid that. This is an example of one of the dangers of having a fixed mindset. It's an interpretation of a one-time event being, oh, this event means this is going to occur every time for all time. Guess what? That's depressing, discouraging, and painful. And good news is, it's false. These, I'll say, ailments or illnesses called attention deficit disorder, ADD, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, they were the real marketing ailments of some years ago. Frankly, the first time I saw MTV, I was like, wow, this is so annoying. They keep changing the images. Like, in one second. So I think MTV and other television programming were accomplices in the proliferation of this problem, as well as they're working in cahoots with Big Pharma and the medical establishment. I used to do this all the time to the annoyance of Marianne. When I noticed this pattern happen, where the images on the screen, the camera angle changed, I would count the seconds. 1 second. One, two, one, 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 two, three, one, one, one. And Tom, I get the point. I said, I know. I'm doing this because it's so clear what they're doing with our attention. They're making us hyperactive. It's like, So I don't see ADD or ADHD as a representing a deficit of attention. I see it due to the ineffective control of one's attention. Of course, giving your attention to a TV program means that you're not controlling your attention other than I'm going to turn the TV on and maybe select something to watch. After that, the program, the creators of the program, the advertisers, and others are controlling our attention. I also see this problem of unfinished cycles being related to a lack of skill in determining relative importances. Understanding relative importances is the idea that if we had 10 items on our to-do list, we would be able to determine and do the most important items before we did the least important items. You know, this kind of reinforces the idea of the 80-20 rule. Was like, 80% of your satisfaction is going to come from 20% of the items on your list. 80% of the rewards will come from doing 20% of the actions on your list. 20% of your satisfaction are going to come from the other 80 items. So, dude, don't bother with those items yet. Do the most important stuff. However, if all the items on our to-do list seem to have the same relative importances, we could easily jump from item to item because we couldn't realize which is more important and which is less important. So we'd be faced with this kind of goofy situation. We couldn't realize that putting out a fire in the kitchen was more important than answering a ringing telephone or checking our email. It's like, we definitely want to know how to do that. One of the factors that I use to influence myself to finish cycles is to consider who is waiting for me to pass on my work. Now, if I'm writing a letter to myself and that I can delay the finish without affecting anybody else, it's just me and it's no big deal. I can do it now or I can do it later. Who cares? However, if I'm writing a thank you note or a sympathy card, the amount of time between the event that spurred that, you know, somebody was kind and generous with me or somebody had a loss, the receipt of the card that I would write and by that other person between the event and the receipt of that card, that becomes important. So I was like, 11 years ago, I meant to send this card to you, and I'm thanking you for... that's not a good idea. If I'm writing a report that will influence how we're going to direct the company, the people waiting for that report are basically stymied until they get it. That fact creates a sense of urgency in me. And it's similar in some ways to working in a factory, right? I'm on a factory, I'm in an assembly line where my work is one phase in a production upon which people and other phases are all relying. And most of us want to be responsible for doing our part if the reward of good feelings about ourselves and others outweighs the risk of bad feelings about ourselves and others. And if the anticipation of bad feelings causes us to shy away from finishing cycles, the solution is to change our anticipation habits. Change our anticipation habits. Guess what? Anticipation is based on past experiences and what they meant to us. If the meanings were pain and hurt and shame and embarrassment and humiliation and, I don't know, fill in the blanks with other negatives, we can revisit those events and change those conclusions. That's the solution. That's the solution. It didn't prove that we were incompetent. It didn't prove that we were bad. It didn't prove that we were dumb or this or that. It was a necessary step in our development of awareness and skill. Oh, it was a necessary step? Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't a permanent blight or a negative mark against us. That's a whole different ballgame. I love the law of cause and effect. I'd love to live in harmony with it, too. And this is an area for all of us, but I'm saying it for myself, is a growth opportunity. A lot of bad feelings that human beings have is due to feeling powerless or helpless. We fail to recognize how causative we can be and how we can actually cause effects. Frankly, when we make a determination that we are helpless or powerless, we are being causative. It's like, oh, I thought I was giving a report. No, you're not. You're giving a command. Whoops. Yeah, exactly. We learn to believe that we have to be afraid of effects. I caused an effect and then I got criticized. I caused an effect and I got yelled at. I caused an effect and then I got embarrassed. And we're also afraid of the effects that other people cause. And here we are, it's like, oh, I got to avoid causing effects and I have to avoid people who cause effects. That's not that great of an idea. Instead of knowing that causing is a skill that is learned through the practice of and trial of error, we take those specific energy exchange experiences and the results that we caused and the meanings that we made up about those experiences, and then we label ourselves and life and God and other people to be that way permanently. One event, we globalize it and permanentize it. Not that good of an idea. Imagine this sci-fi scenario, because this is basically what we do. An alien materials on the surface of planet Earth, kind of like a Star Trek transporter scene, right? Boom, and now there he is. And where he lands, it's raining and the temperature is just above freezing. The alien is immediately soaked and miserable. And says to itself, Earth is always wet and cold. I don't like it. I wish I had never come here. I'm stupid for doing this. The alien distorted the time factor about its experience. It also overlooked the factor of space. It took one experience and made up its mind that all experiences on Earth would be the same. It was one experience at one time in one space. That's all. The problem for the alien is the same problem for us. It made the experience about itself instead of keeping it about the weather in that one specific spot at that one specific time. Notice the difference in the negative energy here. There's much less negative energy in, it's raining and it's cold and I am very wet. Consider this. It's always raining and cold. I don't like it. I wish I had never come here. I'm stupid for doing this. That's a lot of self-referencing, huh? Let me reference another television program. We could learn from the Joe Friday character from the TV series, Dragnet. Joe would instruct witnesses as a detective to, he would say, I only need the facts, not their interpretation of what they saw or what they heard or what they think they saw or what they think they heard. And he would say, just give me the facts, ma'am. Nothing but the facts. Human beings make things up. Making things up is how we create. It's how we cause effects. Making things up is good if we know we are making things up. And there's the challenge. We make things up without realizing that we are making things up. We are causing effects without realizing we're causing effects. And then what we do is we look at the effects, wonder how they came about, and then feel victimized by circumstances, bad luck, genes, or even other people, or God, or by ourselves, or fate. We make things up. Finishing cycles is about making up the end of those cycles. It's about making up our minds and our mindsets. We've all heard this expression, make up your mind. In other words, choose a viewpoint, choose an attitude, make a decision, imagine it. You can do it. It's like, In the book, which I highly recommend, titled Mindset, The New Psychology of Success by Carol Dweck, she talks about making plans more concrete in order to make it easier for us to take action, to follow through. The when, the where, and the how we are going to do something, if those things are defined, made more concrete, more visual, then it's going to lead to higher levels of follow through. That idea has been applied in many different programs and in many different areas of life. And the people who are most effective have learned how to do these steps until they become habits. In fact, these same steps are used to break habits, including the really difficult habit of breaking cigarette smoking. Smoke Enders and a man from England, Alan Carr, who I'll say cannibalized Smoke Enders processes to quit smoking, 3.5-4 packs a day habit. Those two organizations would teach that a smoker needs to decide on when to quit smoking, and that when needs to be not today, not tomorrow, but it needs to be out in the future, rather than an impulsive, I'm going to quit tomorrow morning. Not that. So putting that date 14 days or 30 days out provides ample opportunity to develop some self-reinforcing talk and one's commitment to actually quitting smoking. It turns that 14 to 30 days or so into a slow but steady strengthening, kind of like a pep rally. I'm going to quit, going to quit, going to quit, going to quit, quit. That momentum, that internal energy is being built up. For me, in January 1975, as I was quitting smoking, the where was a given. It was where I was living. I didn't have to go very far. It was right there. The how, I think, I chose as a trigger point. I decided in advance that when I ran out of cigarettes that I bought while I was still in the U.S. Army, which cost me an offensive 20 cents a pack, $2 a carton. Nowadays, you have to take a second mortgage to buy a carton of cigarettes. But I decided that when I ran out of those cigarettes, I was going to quit cold turkey. Well, when I seemed to run out of cigarettes, I searched high and low. Boy, I was looking for cigarettes. I went into the car multiple times. I looked in the trunk. I looked under the seat in the glove compartment. I looked every possible place in the house that a cigarette or a pack of cigarettes could hide. No cigarettes. I quit. 2 days later, I found a pack of cigarettes in the car. I said, no way, no way. This is a trick. This is a trick. It wasn't there a couple of days ago. Nope, nope. I searched high and low. I was thorough. I stayed quit. Part of finishing cycles for me involves another thing, is to become aware of the negative consequences. And that applied to cigarette smoking, too. I realized that I was a slave, which provoked my decision to quit smoking. Not just the bad habit, not just smelling like an ashtray, not just the cost of doing it. I was a slave. So being clear about negative habits or the negative consequences of a habit can reinforce your commitment. So I needed to make the negative consequences more concrete too. So the carrot was clearly visualized, and it needs to whenever you're trying to finish a cycle. If you can clearly visualize the carrot, that is the reward, and you can feel it, your commitment's going to be strong. And if your downside or the negatives related to not doing something are also clearly visualized and emotionally felt, that acts like a stick. Ooh, I got to get away from that. I got to move forward. I got to take steps toward finishing this because that doesn't feel good. And that will result in an even stronger commitment. I'm suggesting that with a clear understanding of the rewards of finishing cycles, with a clear understanding of what the finish actually looks and feels like, and an awareness of the pain and punishment, and largely it's self-punishment from self-talk, of not finishing a cycle, we're going to be able to manage ourselves so much more effectively and finish cycles. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized and modified version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Because Marianne, to me, is the epitome of love expressed in physical form, I include her in this prayer. I say this prayer before I get out of bed in the morning, and it's one of the final things I do at night as I lie in bed. Father, Mother, Life, Marianne, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us again and again and again. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know that you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives and our family and our friends into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.